Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Over the past few years, I've done somewhere around 75 or 80 interviews with authors of monographs, editors of journals, article authors, all of these about specific genocides or issues related to genocide. But I don't ever recall having talked about the question of how one teaches about the subject. So to remedy that, I've invited John Cox and Adam Jones to talk about how one writes a text about genocide, why one writes such a text, and how writing a text about genocide is different than writing and teaching about other subjects. Both John and Adam have long histories in the community of genocide scholars. Both have written important and influential texts, and both have been on the show before. Adam is professor of political science at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. And John is Associate Professor of International Studies at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and also directs the Center for Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies there. John, Adam, welcome back, and thanks for joining us again on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here.
Pleasure to be here.
So before we actually start talking about the text, maybe each of you could take just a moment and reintroduce yourselves to the audience. Say something about who you are and how you got to be that way, and how you got to be somebody interested in studying mass violence. And John, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, that's funny. I just recently had to come up with a concise way of explaining how I became pulled into this area of study, because I think it maybe in earlier generations, especially of Holocaust history, people often came to it because of family connections and things like that. But anyway, I think I really found myself being drawn in the direction that ultimately led to getting a PhD in history and studying anti-Nazi resistance, and then going from there into a more expansive area of comparative genocide. I think in large part because of my growing up in the South in the United States in the 60s and 70s and becoming attuned to issues of racism and injustice, but more specifically racism and white supremacy. And then while in college in the 1980s, I kind of had a social and political, and historical, awakening, so to speak, through some classes I was taking at the same time that I became involved in the movement in solidarity with the peoples of South Africa, with the South African freedom struggle, as well as with people in Central America who were dealing with U.S. foreign policy, which of course was consisted of military dictatorships and genocidal regimes such as in Guatemala. So I think it was kind of at the same time I was taking some courses on the Holocaust, and it was unusual to have courses specifically on the Holocaust back in the early 80s, that these things, my political and intellectual interests kind of merged, which I think ultimately led me on a path, for better or worse, toward teaching and writing about genocide. And so,
and John, No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, eventually, I also was out of college for many years. I was involved in political activism and in attempting to organize labor unions, which led to being fired many times, and then, and then eventually deciding I should go into a line of work that might provide tenure, so, which definitely doesn't exist in the kind of textile mills and meatpacking plants where I worked 25 years ago. But then eventually I decided to go to grad school and ended up at the University of Chapel Hill, where I worked with Chris Browning, among others.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you could say just a few things about the center you direct?
Yes, please. Thanks for asking. And in fact, the best thing that anyone out there could do to combat genocide would be to support my center. but anyway, it's one of many such centers that tries to combine educational mission with outreach and with action. And we also try to not be Holocaust-centric. And so the name does, I think, reflect our mission, Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies. To tell you the honest truth, I think in a more perfect world, we should be able to just say genocide studies, because obviously that encompasses the Nazi Holocaust. But yeah, the center, I helped to found and get the center moving when I came here 7.5 years ago. And so we bring in speakers, we organize panels and organize research and so on, as well as having a minor in this field. We're moving towards perhaps having a teaching certificate. And we do a lot of work in the community, especially around issues such as immigrant rights and refugee rights and advocacy. And we're also holding our first big international conference a few months from now, which is on the topic of genocide denial.
That's wonderful.
Which I am looking forward to attending, I must
wonderful.
Say.
And so, Adam, that's a good segue. Why don't you talk about tell us about yourself?
Yeah, well, it's kind of nice, first of all, to be asked the question without an underlying tone of what on earth would make you interested in a topic like that, which I think is something that genocide scholars pretty often deal with, and something that I also deal with right up front in the preface of my textbook, and try to justify that to a certain extent and to explain why I find it a very challenging and vigorous field of study. One of the advantages, I think, and one of the really special, if not unique, features of genocide studies is that virtually nobody comes to it with a degree in genocide studies. It is a combination of disciplinary backgrounds, which I think is like nothing I've ever seen. And I think that's something that drew me eventually to the field. I'd always had a strong interest in human rights issues. And like John, I did activism around Central American issues in particular during the 1980s. That was pretty much where I cut my teeth, and the case of Guatemala was very much front and center at that time, and the discourse of genocide around Guatemala was there, but we were still experiencing the very early days of a field of comparative genocide studies, and my research at the graduate level was very much in a different direction. I focused on mass media and political transition, which has some overlap with, you know, issues of civil and human rights, but is otherwise quite divorced from what I ended up specializing in. But in the 1990s, I got very interested in the issue of gender and mass violence in particular. I was doing my master's at McGill in Montreal when the December 8th, 1989 massacre happened just up the road at the École Polytechnique, when 14 young women were murdered by a deranged gunman who felt that he had been frozen out of higher education by feminists. And that got me thinking in a very vivid way. I mean, I walked past the caskets of those women, and it got me thinking in a systematic way for the first time about gender and violence, but not only mass gendered violence against women and girls, but against men and boys also, which is probably the area of early research that first attracted some interest and attention. I was doing that in the context of a political science and international relations focused degree. I wrote some early stuff for journals like Ethnic and Racial Studies, focusing on an inclusive approach to gender and mass violence. And then in 1999 happened both the outbreaks of mass violence and arguably genocide in Kosovo and East Timor. And I started blogging around those events. I started thinking systematically. I arrived at this concept of gendercide and then discovered that somebody had used it before me. And that was really my entree to the earliest writings in the field of comparative genocide studies. If I wanted to kind of theorize this idea of gendercide, then I needed to know something of the background theory of genocide. And then I'm sure, like John, once you immerse yourself in this particular subject, it has a way of getting its hooks into you and holding you there and making its own use of you. So that was pretty much the birth of my interest in the field, at least.
And so you've both been active in this in a while. Why, and I'll start with Adam, why write a textbook?
Yeah, that came about quite fortuitously as I was attending a conference in South Africa, in Durban, and happened to be seated next to a representative from Routledge Publishers named Craig Fowley. Craig had the very agreeable job, I thought, of flying around the world at company expense and buttonholing seemingly promising, especially younger scholars, finding out their field of study and interest and research, and then often following up with the question, is there a good textbook on that? And that was how things played out at that dinner at that conference. And it gave me pause. And I said, well, you know, we have a couple of anthologies. We have History and Sociology of Genocide by Chalk and Jonasson. That was probably the earliest widely used textbook in comparative genocide studies, I said, but I'm not sure there's anything that really does justice to the interdisciplinary aspect of the field and something that's written accessibly and that also has a strong visual component, because I've always been interested in the visual arts. I do a lot of photography in addition to my research and writing. And I wanted something that would be visually involving for an ideal student and general reader, something that would work well at both undergraduate and graduate levels, but would also be accessible just to interested members of the public. And within 15 hours, I guess, of that dinner, I had a draft proposal to Craig, stayed up a little bit late to put it together, and things went from there. And it has established itself certainly as one of the go-to texts in the field, which is very gratifying.
Now, I'm always struck by how important chance encounters can be in shaping careers. I've heard that again and again talking to authors. John, what about you? Why did you write a textbook?
Yeah, well, I'd say, also just to pick up on your point about chance encounters, I think one reason my textbook ended up being published and being published with Oxford University Press was because at one point 10 years earlier, I answered an email that a publisher probably sent to every assistant professor in the country, especially at universities where they were being so desperately underpaid that they would jump at a chance to make $100 by like doing a review of a Western Civilization textbook or something. But by doing that, I developed a relationship with this one editor who then later moved to OUP. And then, so at any rate, it was in some sense the genesis of my book, I suppose. But Yeah, I think I wrote, I decided to write a textbook, I guess in part because as a historian, as he said, I'm a professor of international studies, but I'm really a historian with a PhD in history. And so the big thing is turning your dissertation into a book. That book invariably, I mean, in my case, I think was actually a reasonably interesting book with a broader appeal than many such books. But then you get tenure based on that, and then you can actually write something more interesting with a broader appeal, which is just is one of many examples of the kind of upside down values and priorities in the academic world. But seriously, that you have to have a little bit of freedom and security to write things that are kind of broader and so on. But anyway, I guess I wrote it because I thought that there are a lot of very good books out there. Adam mentioned one or two. To tell you the honest truth, Adam's book is really the best book of that in that genre. But I thought that there was a little space for a slightly slimmer book that could be carried around without the assistance of a wheelbarrow. But in all seriousness, Adam's book is really marvelous, and it's great that he has the support of his publisher to have images and so on like that too, which really enhances it greatly. But I'd say outside of Adam's book, a handful of others, it's very difficult to find like just a 20 or 25 page chapter on the Armenian genocide or on the Cambodian genocide. Because there are some other books that are really marvelous, like Specters of Genocide and so on, but that may have been where individual chapters might have have come at it from a certain specialized focus and so on, rather than kind of providing some background and an overview and so on, in addition to making some original connections and analyses and so on. So anyway, it just seemed to me that there was definitely room for the kind of book that which I think I've written. So I'd say that's one big reason is to that I thought that there was a void for this. And also I really set out to write the book in a way that it could be useful in classrooms, but could also reach a broader audience. Again, like Adams, I think that there's definitely a general readership out there. And I've often gotten emails from people since it was published a couple of years ago attesting to that I think Adam and I both have a way of writing and of speaking that is accessible and also kind of condenses a lot of a lot of secondary as well as primary research.
I'll return the compliment and say that I think that John's book is the best short introduction to genocide studies by a substantial margin. I think one thing that both of us were aiming for and trying to compensate for, in a sense, was that virtually everything that had been used as a textbook, or of course, reading packages assembled by faculty, which was, I think, a quite common way of handling the text requirement in the early days of the field, they lacked the kind of unifying authorial voice. And I wanted to do something that had a kind of personal and even tone from beginning to end, and that was approachable and accessible in a style that I think both John and I have worked and striven for. And, so the idea was to have something that was conversational in some ways and that would draw people in rather than intimidating them with the subject matter or, for example, on the visual front, confronting them with a lot of atrocity images. That's another aspect of crafting things, particularly for younger readers about such a sensitive and bleak subject, is how do you represent that visually. But yeah, we were both looking, I think, to have our voices come through, and I think we both succeeded in that.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you talk about images. I'm wondering if, and I suspect it is, so maybe how writing a text about genocide is different from writing a different kind of textbook. Adam, did you find this a different process because of the subject?
Yeah, the only texts I've written are on genocide and another one on crimes against humanity, so I'm not sure how much I have to compare it for. But I've also written at some length about the particular challenges that come with dealing with this subject matter, the challenges of presenting it visually in a way that is evocative of genocide, but is not kind of constantly assaultive. One other thing that I would mention in that context is the challenge of humanizing and individualizing the theme, because as Stalin is reputed to have said, a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic, and he certainly knew about that. But how do you get beyond these vast and abstract numbers? I've tried to do that partly through the visual element, but also by constantly sampling the testimony of witnesses and survivors and victims, you know, posthumously, really trying to give people a sense of the human dimension and the human consequences of these atrocities.
Yeah, if I may say, yeah, I think that's one of many really effective features, and also that I see, Adam, in your third edition, you're able to do even a little bit more with that, the kind of breakouts or boxes called like one person story and so on, because yeah, that is also
At the price of making it a 900 page book further opening the niche for yours, we might say.
That's right. That's one reason I applaud your efforts to continue.
So, John, you, as you say, your book is much shorter. You don't have the luxury of including a lot of the testimony and the firsthand accounts that Adam has done. How did you try and wrestle with that challenge of writing about this kind of subject?
Also like Adam, for me, it wasn't like a deviation from that is, I didn't have to take a break from another book called Nice People Doing Nice Things to One Another in order to work on the genocide book. But also like Adam, I think just as far as the challenge, the kind of, let's say, emotional challenge or whatever, is that I think the two of us are good examples of probably just about everyone you talk to, Kelly. You know, all of us who are in this field, we are in it because somehow we see enough other things going on in the world and in human history that we have kind of some kind of way of balancing or maybe integrating our understanding of human potential for good and bad and everything else in between. And so also in the book, I try to I incorporate some images and some anecdotes and stories and spotlights on examples of resistance and human solidarity, but in a measured way that's not false, you know, because one thing I really dislike intensely is when I pick up a book by Primo Levi or someone at a book shelf, and on the back of it, it says, "This is a heartwarming, uplifting story." I'm like, no, it's not. But within even the worst tragedies in human history, we find examples of other human responses. But it's all very complex. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who I don't quote too often, although he's at least from his later years, but he has a nice quote that I think I probably got from, because James Waller used it in Becoming Evil, that there's not some line. It would be nice to separate the world into the evildoers and the good people, but instead there's some line that cuts through each of us and a line that might move around, you know, in teaching and educating about the Holocaust. And I often am part of organizing and participating in teacher training workshops for high school teachers and so on. I try to get people past thinking of like bystander, victim, et cetera, and that a single, an individual might resist or defy Nazism in one moment and then be some sort of an accomplice in the next, and so on. But yeah, I'd say for me, a challenge was, well, first of all, with the help of my editor, just to come up with the four case studies I wanted to focus on. But that wasn't too terribly difficult in terms of just thinking of ways of having some geographic and thematic breadth and balance and so on. But also at the moment, I'm actually working on an expanded second edition. And so now it's a little bit more challenging for me to pitch some ideas and get them accepted about exactly which way to, about which other episodes to include. but I'm arguing for. Yeah, well, I'm not expanding that rapidly.
Yeah, I think John makes a really interesting point there, that the question of individualizing the encounter with genocide is also an individual encounter with one's personal capacity and collective propensity for genocide. And for that reason, for example, I began my case study section quite deliberately with genocides of indigenous people rather than a more iconic genocide like the Jewish Holocaust. I adopted a chronological approach and that placed sort of initially and centrally the phenomenon of genocides of indigenous people. And that brings the majority of our readers who are students in settler colonial societies face-to-face with the legacy of their own collective involvement in genocide, benefit from genocide, and encourages them to be self-critical about their own histories and legacies, and then also to look within themselves and to recognize that there is, as Nancy Shepherd Hughes called it, a genocidal continuum, that there are many stages along that continuum where you can see, even in daily practice and in the functioning of ordinary societal institutions, that kind of seed of genocide. And so encouraging people to look around at their own relationships, the patterns of privilege and underprivilege in their own societies, and the way that some of this fuel for atrocities, including genocide, is always all around us.
So I've written material designed to be used in a classroom, but I've never written a text. So this is maybe an assumption, and you can tell me if it's a bad one. But I'm assuming you need to do some kind of internal analysis of the state of the field as you decide what to cover and how. So I'm wondering how you both would, how would you describe the state of the field of genocide studies now, Adam?
Sorry, starting with Adam? Yes. I think it's continues to proliferate in an interdisciplinary sense. We're just getting more and more contributions from new fields in the social sciences. I would mention the kind of proliferation of criminological literature, for example, about genocide. We're seeing spillover into the natural sciences with the forensic strand and the satellite remote sensing strand, for example, of contributions to these fields. So in a sense, the most invigorating thing about the field, which is its unusual interdisciplinarity, has continued to play itself out in really notable ways. I think we're also continuing the trend of seeing ever greater attention to case studies from both the past and the present, a determination to uncover or recover past cases and analyze them through the analytical lens of genocide, and also to look around the world today and fasten upon not only specific political military events of the more kind of traditional genocidal kind, but perhaps also structural and institutional and background forms of violence and the way that they can also be considered part of the genocidal continuum. We have a lot of younger scholars that are being drawn to the field. There's a lot of energy at the international conferences for genocide studies, and so I don't see any sign of this wave of interest cresting anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree with everything Adam just said. I just started graduate school 20 years ago, and I kind of came, like a lot of people who come into what, you know, what we call genocide studies, usually came from one particular genocide, which in my case was the Holocaust. But then I already was deeply knowledgeable about a lot of other things, especially Latin American history and African American history. And so, but then as I began to learn about the field, I could already see around the turn of this last century that it was a young field, obviously. And so I think in just 30 or 35 years, you know, basically two generations, it seems to me that the field has definitely expanded in a lot of very, very fruitful directions. I think we've helped to kind of eclipse or maybe resolve some early, well, I mean, some tensions still exist, certainly in relation to how the Holocaust fits into various things. But to me, a lot of those things have been effectively confronted. And yeah, as Adam says, I think there's a lot of really exciting directions that things are going in. I've got a number of students, and I don't even have the luxury of having graduate students here, but I've got some really good undergrads who are working on things like something about capitalism and genocide, looking at, and actually, and this young man is going in more creative directions than I would have originally thought. And as I'm working with someone else who's working on a computer modeling of factors that can bring about genocidal violence. And then I think also, it seems to me that as we proceed, that I think we're getting further away from clinging to a really rigid and static and legalistic understanding of genocide that is based on a strict 1948 definition. And so I think then that there's a lot more, that the boundaries are a lot more porous maybe than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Between genocide studies and, you know, critical race studies, histories of race and racism, and various other fields.
So let me follow up on that, John, because I've actually got a question in my notes that is simply, what are your books about? In other words, both of your books have the word genocide in them, and you both spend some time talking about terms. So what are you writing about? And John, I kind of interrupted you, so I'll let you go on. I think you were headed there.
Thank you. Because actually, I had to kind of think about that recently because I was invited to give a big talk. My university invites three or four people who've written books in the previous year to give a big talk that they make a big deal about and so on. And so I had to think about how to reduce things to a short talk and get quickly to the heart of the matter, which is not exactly what I'm doing now, but I think that my book is really about racism, maybe more than anything. And so I think that that's kind of a thread that goes through it that unifies that unifies every part of the book. Racism, of course, is a relatively modern invention of human beings over the last 300 or 400 years, but then my book really focuses on modern genocide, and the subtitle is about genocide in the 20th century. So after an introduction that deals with some earlier periods, it really focuses on basically from King Leopold and the Herero Nama genocides up to the present. So I'd say that my book is largely really about racism and about its consequences and its functioning. And because, of course, after inventing race and racism, the Europeans and their benevolence brought it with them to Rwanda and Cambodia and elsewhere. And so it really does explain a lot. And I think it's also what I try to use to give my book. Well, I think both of us write with a sense of moral urgency, you know, and to me, for me, that's not difficult. I guess, again, because of my even my background as a political activist and so on. It would be very difficult for me to write in like an antiseptic, you know, sort of fashion. But I think in a measured way, it's important to, again, to convey moral indignation and so on. I heard one of my mentors was Chris Browning, and he brought Yehuda Bauer to speak on our campus at Chapel Hill about 20 years ago. And I remember Bauer saying something like, every historical problem is a moral problem. And I thought that summed it up because we're often in our fields, in the United States at least, often taught to be unbiased, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. And but I admit to my students I have a bias against racism and Nazism and so on, which are things that are back in vogue in this country. and sometimes I'll even have someone higher up in the UNC system will say, you should tone down some blog you've written about this or that. And I'm like, we're not supposed to talk about Trump. I'm like, really? So an outrageously racist, sexist, xenophobic things are going on right in front of you. We should, let's talk about something happening halfway around the globe, but not about something that's right in front of us.
Yeah. Now that question of moral indignation, I think, is something that guides all genocide scholars. And, you know, by contrast, perhaps with some more quote unquote objective and hands off fields of study, people get into this in part because they want to understand the phenomenon, in part because they want to change the world on some level and work to address and suppress the phenomenon in question. So we all have, I think, that dimension of activism and advocacy. And I think for that reason, what I wanted to do in the textbook was be both backward-looking and forward-looking, and talk both about the history and legacy of genocide and the origins and evolution of the concept of genocide and all of its fascinating twists and turns and ambiguities. I mean, it is truly an essentially contested concept. And following the theoretical working out of that in the field has been a fascinating thing. So I think many people are drawn for that advocacy dimension. And one of the other positive, or shall we say constructive, dimensions of the field is the opportunity that I think it gives you to immerse yourself in human history and contemporary events. I have always been kind of an information junkie for the past and present. And it allows me to, for example, if I want to understand the Rwandan genocide of 1994, and for that matter, the Congolese genocide that follows very much on its heels, I need to immerse myself in a really sustained and systematic way in the historical writings on the Great Lakes region of Africa, the work of anthropologists, the work of geographers, journalists, whomever I can lay my hands on. And I think that I wanted to do justice to the nourishing intellectual exercise of understanding how this atrocious institution has established itself in human affairs, and understanding the range of strategies available to confront it. And one thing I'd just mention finally in that context is that I think it's very important, particularly when you're dealing with younger students who may be confronting these issues for the first time. I mean, I have students in junior high school who have used at least a chapter or two of my work, and I'm always wondering about what on earth is going through their minds as they read through this. It is important to hold out a prospect of hope, and not to do that for simply romantic reasons, but because the legacy of this particular mass atrocity is also a legacy of attempts to intervene and to confront it. And in my final chapter, I have a long section that is titled Success Stories? Because you need to interrogate the extent to which they're success stories, but where I go through a number of cases from Rwanda to the European Union and a range of other positive examples of situations where you would think that the type of societal divisions that exist could be fuel for genocide. Indeed, in the case of Europe, have been fuel for it in the recent past, and how instead different options have been chosen and different courses have been pursued as a result of some often really brave norm entrepreneurship, if you want to call it that, which in our field goes right back to Raphael Lemkin and his virtually one-man attempt to establish genocide as an intellectual and historical concept and as a concept in international law.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think you gave a little bit of context, but there may be people in the audience who don't know that phrase. So can you talk a little bit about norm entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I do a lot of work around the phenomenon of international norms and regimes and how it is that regimes understood as institutions or networks of institutions come together, particularly in the field of what we call prohibition regimes, international projects that seek to suppress and outlaw a particular activity. So the prohibition regime against slavery is probably the classic example. And I'm very interested in the ways that activists and advocates come together for morally imbued reasons rather than reasons of personal self-interest to confront these kind of crimes and destructive activities in the national context and the global context. And so a norm entrepreneur is really somebody who is a morally driven activist or advocate for a cause. And the role of those individuals and forces in human history and in international politics today is something that has been pretty effectively studied in my own discipline, international relations. And now has given us a really kind of rich understanding of the diverse set of actors that come together around those causes and the fascinating range of strategies that they employ to kind of entrench these new norms and new moral understandings in international affairs.
So John and Adam just referenced teaching. So this is a question that faces both ways. Some of the people in the audience are teachers. I wonder if you could say a little bit, and again, start with John, about what you've learned about how to teach this kind of subject and what teaching the subject of genocide, how that informed your decisions about writing a textbook.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say, I don't know if I have anything exceptionally profound, but I think that I think one thing I've done increasingly, and I've been teaching now for about 10 years since I got out of grad school, is I'll often pause in a class session or in the semester and ask the students what they wish to talk about more or get into more or what we've rushed past too quickly and so on. So I'd say I definitely do more of that in my genocide classes than I do in other classes. It's a good strategy anyway. It's something I picked up in grad school, was even in the middle of a class session to stop and say, everyone write down something that needs greater clarification, something that you didn't agree with and so on. But I find myself doing that quite regularly in my genocide studies classes, is just to either ask or have people write down topics or questions or themes that they really want to get into more. I guess another thing, a lot of it about teaching is just your personality in the classroom and the way you carry yourself in the classroom. And I suspect, I haven't seen Adam in a classroom, although I brought him here to speak, and I think we both surprised people by being kind of having a senses of humor and being, you know, and being capable of talking about other things and of somehow having some levity and finding side tracks to go on to explore other areas of human history that are related to the topic. It's funny, sometimes I'll have, often on my evaluations, I tend to get good evaluations. People say he's, you know, good, help, you know, helpful, always this and that. But sometimes people say he gets off topic, which I always think is funny because it's like, do you really want me to stay rigidly on topic for 75 minutes, you know? But I'd say some of that is just kind of more a function of your own comfort and your own kind of personal style and so on. But I think that I often will have students say that it just, that they found that without exactly becoming too lighthearted, you know, in a genocide class, that they just found it a lot more kind of interesting and less, you know, emotionally oppressive or something than they would have expected when the semester began.
Yeah. I have to say that I find this quite a novel and useful suggestion on John's part to ask my students what they'd like to hear about, because I think my normal tendency is to some extent just to launch this stuff at them. And particularly when I have only one semester to get through a course that is now built around a textbook that runs close to 900 pages, I really have to work at trying to rein myself in and be more interactive with students and to be sympathetic and sensitive to the impact of kind of bludgeoning young people with case after case and dimension after dimension of these themes. So I'm working on that, but it is still a rather traditional lecture format in my case, in part because I feel that I still have so much that I need to get on the table, particularly in terms of historical and disciplinary backgrounds. And I wrestle with that. I try to compensate to some extent by building the class in a very systematic way around the textbook, which is really why I wrote the textbook in the first place. I envisaged it very much with a number of chapters that would be digestible for a semester's teaching, preferably a full year's teaching, but usually we don't have that luxury. Trying to draw people in an engaging and approachable way into this very off-putting subject and to give them a sense of, hopefully, the intellectual excitement that is associated with engaging with the topic, but engaging with it proactively. All right, we need to understand this in order to be able to craft more effective mechanisms of intervention, and intervention not just understood as sending in the peacekeepers, but interventions at a global level, yes, but at a national level in terms of the policies that our own authorities pursue, and very much at a local and personal level in terms of the relationships that we construct and manage on a daily basis. And particularly once I think you get into some of the later sections of the textbook that talk more about personal responsibility, individual stories of rescuers, which I think is a good way to counteract some of the negativity that inherently comes with the topic, and some of the solutions that can be crafted at all three of those levels, personal, national, and international. I think you can get students engaging in a way that doesn't leave them feeling completely disempowered and overwhelmed. But I'm still grappling.
Yeah, sad to say, even if in our system, I've never had a full year to teach it. So And in fact, I'm lucky when at least once a year, I have a full semester just on genocide. And then I teach another class called Introduction to Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies. And then I teach a class on anti-Nazi resistance. And I teach another class. I'm actually creating a class on the U.S. Vietnam War and its legacies for next semester. But even when I have just a full semester on genocide, and for that class, I use Adam's book. But even with the full semester, I might find myself rushing through East Timor, as well as East Pakistan or Bangladesh, the Al-Anfal in Iraq in the late 80s, and a number of other things. I just barely have a sentence to say about Trujillo's genocide of violence against Haitians in 1937. I'd like to talk more about the Putumayo. There's actually a novel coming out very soon about Roger Casement. In fact, it should be wonderful because it's written by Martin Tuberman, who's a wonderful writer and historian. But even with the full semester, there's so many things that you can barely get into. So yeah, it is all quite challenging. I kind of wish that human beings would eventually stop giving us so much material, you know. But also, you know, I think it's important. I like the way Adam approached some of the things he said a moment ago about that, you know, we'll have students who feel like we must do something to stop this right now. Or what kind of big thing can I do? Like, how can we organize something that will put an end to this? But there are small things that you can do. And there are small, even gestures or small little moments of solidarity and compassion and or of defiance against injustice, against bigotry, that can influence others and have a rippling or residual effect. And I think that's important for people to know. I've learned a lot from studying the history of the African-American freedom struggle. In fact, that really helped me in understanding and analyzing anti-Nazi resistance, that oftentimes, again, it was small acts help to influence other people. So that's important, too. It's, as Adam said, for our students not to feel powerless, is that, you know, big, huge statements and being part of big movements is very important. But small things can also make a real difference.
And also, I would say to emphasize the diversity of those big movements and what they have accomplished in human affairs. That, you know, I certainly draw upon cases like the struggle against slavery, the struggle for women's rights, the struggle for workers' rights, and say, really, look what dramatic changes have been brought about, and often surprisingly rapidly, particularly in geological terms, but, you know, in historical terms, a few decades can make really remarkable transformations. And human beings have exhibited a notable capacity to collectively get to grips with challenges of this type, phenomena that once seemed irredeemably entrenched in human affairs and massively atrocious and yet legal and accepted as slavery once was. And the ability to recast the terms of morality on an international scale, it's always a fraught enterprise. It seems to be always two steps forward, one step back. But there are very notable victories that you can use, I think, pedagogically to encourage students to think constructively about how to intervene in genocide and how over the long term to marginalize.
Yeah, right. You know, Adam and I are, I think we're almost exactly the same age. I think you're a month older than me or younger. I can't remember. But, you know, back in 1985 or 88, we didn't envision Nelson Mandela not only being released from prison, but being elected president in 1994. And people didn't envision the Stalinist regimes of Eastern Europe crumbling, and in 1955, people didn't envision the real progress that would be made in combating institutionalized racism in the United States. So, but all these things also took some imagination. And so, I was just talking with someone outside, and we got in a little bit of an argument about Elizabeth Warren, who's sunk to a bizarre level recently in her, anyway, in talking about blood and genetics and DNA in relation to cultural identity and so on. But we people who consider ourselves kind of progressive or on the left side of things in the U.S., don't have much imagination, which is one reason why there's only two political parties in this country, is because everyone's always afraid to try to do anything new or different. I don't want to go too far with maybe an argument against the Democratic Party at a time when the Republican is represented by the orangey guy who sounds like Mussolini and looks like Berlusconi and so on. But I'll just say that sometimes we kind of lack imagination. But we can see in history where people have had imagination and didn't just think about what was not possible or what is just barely possible within what appears to be, you know, the limitations of the moment. But rather, people had bold moral visions, and movements had bold moral visions that led to real change.
So that's actually a nice transition to as we get to the court toward the end of our time. Anytime you write a book, you learn things, and I know each of you learned an immense amount of stuff as you wrote your books. But I wonder if you could highlight one or two things that you learned from writing this book, a position of yours that might have changed, or a theme that suddenly became more important to you. Maybe talk about one or two. And Adam, why don't we start with you?
I mentioned the example before of engaging with the Rwandan genocide, which I think to some extent for scholars of Mayan and John's generation, we are indeed about the same age. I do want to just stress that means, of course, we were very young children during the end of apartheid there.
Oh, exactly. In fact, it was on my first birthday is when Mandela was elected president, actually.
Yeah.
I guess that would put it on my third birthday. Thank you very much. But go ahead.
Yeah. In terms of what I have learned, the Rwandan genocide, I think for scholars of our generation, has something of the same iconic status that the Jewish Holocaust did for earlier generations. And that's not to get caught up in the whole uniqueness debate or, you know, whether the Rwandan Holocaust is equal to the Jewish predecessor, but it reflects the trauma, I think, that we experienced in the West. Of course, there's a Canadian connection here with the figure of Roméo Dallaire, who was leading the peacekeepers in Rwanda. Just the utter catastrophic abdication of responsibility by the outside world has kind of seared that case into our minds in something of the same way that the Holocaust is seared into the minds of the World War II and after generations. And I felt honored in a way to be able and encouraged to engage with the very complex history of that region. And in the most recent edition of my textbook, by contrast with the first two, instead of having a chapter specifically on the Rwandan genocide and with some tangential comments about Congo and Burundi and related cases, this time the chapter is on genocide in Africa's Great Lakes region. And it is, I think, a quite sophisticated regional study of genocides in those core countries and the way that they spill over and historically have interacted with and triggered atrocities in neighboring countries and indeed continue to do so through to the present day. And for me, that was personally a real advance to be able to immerse myself sufficiently in those generally rather marginal and obscure cases in the literature and to do them some justice in a way that I think draws students into not just the individual cases, but the interrelationships among them. And so I've grown and learned in that sense. And I think I've learned just a lot more also from a pedagogical perspective about how to engage particularly younger people of a range of different ages and familiarity with this subject in the subject and try to head off the obvious dangers of overwhelming them and dispiriting them. In fact, to leave them feeling more engaged and with a sense of hopefully personal empowerment to be able to stage their own interventions.
Yeah, Kelly, I guess I'd have to, I would say that in writing the book, it obviously forced me to undertake just a much closer examination of things that I knew well enough to teach them and speak about with at least a facade of authority and so on. But that's one of the things I really enjoyed about writing this book, or when I have the time to just work on a book rather than trying to balance 20 different things simultaneously during a typical semester and so on, is just spending time sitting, like, for example, in the library at the the place in Amsterdam, the NIOD, you know, Foundation for War, Genocide, the Holocaust, et cetera, the International Social History place outside of Amsterdam, a couple of places in Berlin, and also spent some time in Kigali at the Genocide Memorial Center there. So I'd say it's nice to be back almost in a grad student mode, because I haven't had too much sabbatical time or anything like that. And to just really delve into the complexities, for example, of what was going on in at the time of the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire and so on. So I guess that's just more in the realm of factual knowledge, but also of putting things together in a different way that this book helped to induce me to do.
So I know this is an impossible question to answer, but maybe you could speculate. I want you to imagine that new assistant professor flying to a conference, happening to get seated on an airplane next to an editor who asked them if there's a textbook in genocide studies 20 years from now, what would a new textbook on genocide studies that's 20 years down the road, can you imagine what gaps they will see and how they will try and fill them? And I'll just let whichever one wants to answer first go ahead and let the other one pause and think.
Take it away, John.
Well, actually, they'll probably have at their disposal the Handbook of Genocide Studies that Adam and I are going to put out eventually.
Nice plug. Well done.
because I guess there may be something that we could have more of in a lot of books that exist now. It's things that deal with art, literature, and so on. I would say that's one thing. I think we're already moving to, I think books like Adam's and many others have already gone a pretty good way toward eroding some of the boundaries between something that we might decide is a genocide and something we might decide is merely a massive crime against humanity that has, you know, the same dynamics as something that we designate a genocide. So I think we're already doing good. And actually, I'd say that's something that we could do better at is having lengthy chapters and sections on things like race and racism and so on that could be integrated into things. I mean, in my expanded edition, I'm going to have a chapter on the U.S. war in Vietnam and maybe also a chapter on the history of racism in the United States, but not by feeling compelled to classify either of them with the big capital G, is saying that they're in the same orbit of human behaviors and of institutionalized violence. And so therefore, to understand genocide, we can take in things that we don't have to agree on at the moment are necessarily, you know, fit into most of our definitions of genocide. I mean, for example, even when Darfur was more at the front of our minds 10 years ago, there were people like Mahmoud Mandini who were very entirely legitimate and sensitive and compassionate people who could disagree about whether or not we had to call it a genocide, but agree that it was a massive crime against humanity emanating from the state in Khartoum. that required a response.
Yeah, I'd say my personal hope would be that when that conversation takes place on an airplane in 20 years' time, the person would respond that, you know, they're old now, but you really still can't do better than Cox or Jones.
They're almost in their mid-40s. They're in their mid-40s now.
But, you know, I think to a certain extent, if we were to pat ourselves on the back just a little, I think John and I could say that we have established something of a model for future textbooks of genocide studies. I think they all need to wrestle, or all future authors will feel a need to wrestle on some level with the origins of the phenomenon historically and its emergence conceptually. I think they will all be interested in providing a range of case studies in some form or another. I think they will all need to do justice to the interdisciplinary nature of the field, which of course will evolve in unforeseeable ways over the next 20 years. And they will all need to get to grips with the dimension of prevention and intervention. Those core elements, which both John and I address, it's hard for me to see them shifting fundamentally in the future. There will be many different takes on that. There will be different disciplinary emphases, and there will be fundamentally different theoretical orientations. And the one question that I have continued to wrestle with over the course of multiple editions of my own textbook is what I have dubbed the return to Lemkin in comparative genocide studies. And what that references above all is the attempt to incorporate the kind of cultural and sociological understanding of genocide, which is at the heart of Raphael Lemkin's original conception, that the fundamental crime did not inhere in the physical extermination necessarily of the targeted group, but was aimed at the foundations of identity and solidarity among them. And I have debated that a lot internally, and in fact have put forward a definition and understanding of genocide that is more clearly focused on the mass killing dimension than is Lemkin's. Lemkin himself was ambivalent at points, and you can find some support for this even in his writings and framings. You can, of course, find support for it in the United Nations Convention, which does put physical killing first and foremost among genocidal strategies. And you can find justification for it just empirically in the way that the international law and advocacy around genocide has played out. But it's still a somewhat controversial move. And there are still people like Martin Shaw, for example, that have moved in a more sociological direction. And I've tried to do justice to that, particularly in the initial and framing chapter of my textbook, by asking what is fundamentally destroyed in genocide and engaging with that debate and making clear to people where I personally stand, but that there are other framings and options available in approaching the subject. And it will be interesting to see in 20 years' time whether the field has moved increasingly in that direction towards a more kind of sociological and maybe structural slash institutional understanding of genocide, or whether it remains fairly heavily concentrated on cases of systematic mass killing of groups, of individuals targeted on the basis of their group membership. That's really the one theoretical question that I'm interested to see played out. Lastly, I would say that I think probably the single most prominent strand in the field over the last couple of decades has been focused upon genocides of indigenous peoples. I think they are ever more central in our understandings of genocide, and I'll be interested to see whether in 20 years' time they have something of the same centrality or a greater centrality in our understanding of the concept and the history.
We've come to the end of our time, and to the listeners, I recommend both books highly. They're both wonderful. I think we should start some kind of betting pool to see whether Adam's next edition will exceed 1,500 pages or will it be restricted to
13. I promise it will be shorter. I promise it will be shorter.
So, John, you referenced the book that you and Adam are working on. Do you want to say just a word or two about what that is and when it might be out?
I'm not sure about the second part of your question, but I'll just say it'll be a multi-author volume, perhaps as many as 40 chapters, and we're going to try to go outside of what we've seen in some similar volumes, with, for example, a more attention to things like a section on art, literature, including theater, and sections on some new developments in the field in recent years. But we still need to talk more about our plans. But I think it'll be very exciting, and we'll look forward to discussing it on your show when it makes.
Yeah, I would love to have you when it's done, and whenever you do something in the field. I'd like to end with the question I always end with, although tweaked a little bit for today. And I'd like to ask each of you. I know you've read in many textbooks and referenced some already in the interview. I wonder for our listeners who may have some free time next weekend, I've heard free time exists and is a thing for some people. What textbook would you recommend?
I just used up my quota of free time during the World Cup last summer. And for 31 days, every day I was like, today I'm going to just record these games and watch them later. And before I knew it, I was sitting there watching and being dismayed by watching Mexico lose to Brazil and things like that. But actually, there's a wonderful book about football, soccer, by Eduardo Galeano that I highly recommend. And Kelly, I noticed that you interviewed the fellow who wrote Soccer under the Swastika, which I'm going to pick up. Mm-hmm. Just a couple books kind of in the field. I mean, this book was published a few years ago, and I just picked it up just very recently, was Jean Hotzfeld's third book on Rwanda, The Antelope Strategy. Mm-hmm. And I often find myself reading, but in preparation for a class on the Vietnam War, I've been getting acquainted with a gentleman named Viet Thanh Nguyen, mm-hmm. who's written, I think he's one of these guys who's won a MacArthur Award because he's written so many excellent books in just a very short period of time. But he has a book called Nothing Ever Dies. And he's also has a couple books on refugee experiences in the modern world that I think are very powerful and that are definitely in the realm of, the concerns of genocide studies.
Hmm. And Adam, what would you suggest?
Yeah, I think the most effective kind of anthology reader type volume, which to a certain extent now supersedes some of the earlier efforts like Chalk and Jonasson that I mentioned earlier on, and although it remains an excellent choice, Centuries of Genocide, edited by Totten et al., but Jens Meyer-Henrich's book, Genocide, A Reader, which is published by Oxford University Press, I think is very rich. It's about the right length, not excessively long, and is very up-to-date, probably the most up-to-date in terms of the literature that it is sampling. So that's a particularly good option, I think. And then, of course, there's just been a plethora of excellent work around individual case studies. John mentioned Jean Hatzfeld's work, which is very first of all, compact. You know, all of his books run about 250 pages. I'm not sure what his secret is. Maybe I should chat with him about that. But they're very intimate. They're very lyrical in a way. I mean, they have a literary quality that is unusual in the field. And for that reason, I think could be quite immersive for students. Maybe if I would just mention one book pertaining to a particular case that I think has kind of established itself as a go-to volume in the field. John mentioned earlier on the case of the Herero and Nama in Namibia, which is a good example of a case that has been kind of rescued from history and really analyzed in a fascinatingly broad way so that we understand, for example, the very close linkages between that genocide at the beginning of the 20th century and the later Nazi genocides under Hitler. And I think for with that particular case, a book by David Olusoga and Casper Erickson called The Kaiser's Holocaust is just a kind of model of how to approach an individual case in a really nuanced and well-researched and well-written way, and then in the later stages of the book to really draw some of those historical and comparative connections. So, you know, if there is a book about a previously obscure case of genocide that your listeners wanted to turn to get a sense of what can be done to draw out these hidden histories from the past to provide the kind of text that can be a kind of canonical work to turn to, I think the Kaiser's Holocaust would be a very good example of that.
Yeah, and Kelly, if I may, I know you'd probably like to conclude, but yeah, if I may say, yeah, Adam, I'm glad you pronounced Jens Meyerheinrich's name. And I don't know if I just pronounced it correctly or not, but I have to agree. I think that, no, that book is excellent. It has a publication date of 2014. I just got acquainted with it about a year after that, and I've used it in my class. It's also really not easy to that kind of reader to somehow find, you know, to find 2, 3, 4 page excerpts from many dozens of sources. But I think he does really a masterful job of that. And also his own introduction, about a 40-page introduction, is really marvelous and extremely useful for anyone who's interested in these things. So, yeah, I agree. That's an exceptionally good book, as is the second book that Adam mentioned. And there's also, for people teaching genocide, there's a great BBC documentary. I believe it's called Namibia Genocide and the Second Reich. It's easy to find if you Google it up. And they speak with one of the co-authors of that book, The Kaiser's Holocaust. And they also speak with Benjamin Madley and other experts, and it's a very well-done genocide. Benjamin Madley's recent book on genocide in California in the middle of the 1800s is also, I think, an excellent book of recent origin.
That's called An American Genocide.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I just want to say, excuse me, thank you so much for your time. The listeners don't know we've been working on this for a while, and I appreciate your patience and the ability to clear your schedule on a Friday when you could be doing other things like, oh, perhaps grading or other things that brought us into the profession.
I'd much rather talk about genocide. I have a huge pile of midterms, and I'm delighted to spend an hour and a quarter talking with you and Adam rather than grading.
Well, it's been a great discussion.
I have a different pile of midterms, and I very much enjoyed the break from them as well.
Well, thank you both. I hope that, as John suggested, you'll be willing to come back and talk about your next book when it's done. But until then, thanks again, and have a great rest of the semester.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Adam Jones and John Cox about their books, Genocide, A Comprehensive Introduction, and To Kill a People, Genocide in the 20th Century. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers, or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time, when I'll talk with Paul Thomas Chamberlain about his book, The Cold War's Killing Fields, Rethinking the Long Peace. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.